What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in. This episode, I speak with John Wolfram. John Wolfram joined the U.S. Navy in 1967 and graduated the underwater demolition training in Coronado, California, in May 1968. As a Navy frogman, he was twice deployed to the war in Vietnam, where he received a Purple Heart from a leg wound inflicted during battle with the Viet Cong. John assisted in the Apollo 10 astronaut and space recovery and was the first frogman in the water to rescue Apollo 11 astronauts Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and Michael Collins after their historical moon landing. John is the author of Splashdown, The Rescue of a Navy Frogman, first published in 2008. He is now involved in missions work around the world with special interest in the country of Vietnam. In 2018, he raised funds to build a memorial Bible college in central Vietnam to honor five fallen SEAL teammates and three hometown friends. I had him on for about 45 minutes. I really enjoyed it. It was very cool to talk with someone who brushed with history in this way, and I think you'll enjoy it. And now I give you John Wolfram. Okay, I'm here with John Wolfram. John, thanks for coming on the podcast, sir.
You're welcome.
It's a pleasure to have you on. I'm very excited to have you on. So I want to discuss, John, obviously your time as a frogman, of course. I want to discuss Apollo 11 and what you're doing now. But before we do that, John, could you please tell our listeners sort of briefly who you are and what you do?
Well, right now, I'm a retired missionary. Before that, I was in the Navy a short 4 years, but it was crammed full of exciting moments.
To put it mildly. Yeah, what was it that made you decide to join the Navy, John?
Well, you have to remember back. You probably look too young to remember back that far, but the 60s, the Vietnam War was going on. And when I become 17, 18, towards my senior year there, if you didn't have plans to go to college or get married, so forth, you're going to be drafted. And I didn't have plans to go to college immediately. And so I started seeking out what branch of service I'd like to be a part of. In junior high school, I saw a film on TV about the Navy frogmen. I thought that would be really fun. So I went to see my Navy recruiter, and he smiled at me and said, sure, sign right here. And I think he was a little surprised when I came back and I had made it through the much training.
What was the training like, John?
Well, back then, we had 18 weeks of basic underwater demolition training. The first 6 weeks was physical preparation that ended in a motivation week called Hell Week. That was like 6 nights, 5 days without any sleep. And then we went into the diving phase. And then after that phase, we went into the demolition phase. And then you join a team. We were given a choice. Back then, there was a SEAL team, one on the West Coast, and there was a UDT-11 and a UDT-12. And then later on, they had a UDT-13. So me and a few of my classmates decided we wanted to be more involved in the frogman phase than in the SEAL team phase. So we signed, and that's where we ended up.
Excellent. Excellent. So just so I'm clear, if for no one else than just for me, what exactly is a frogman, John?
Well, I was asked that when I was in a church many years ago. This pastor, believe it or not, wanted to bring out people. So the Sunday school had me dress up in my wetsuit and my goggles and my fins. And this kid was so disappointed. He said, he ain't green. But I think the frogman came in popularity probably during World War II when they needed to clear the beaches and so forth. Men volunteered from the Navy and other branches, I assume, to clear those beaches, to dive underwater, set demolition charges, clear out the obstacles so the ships could come in and land the troops. So maybe that's where it began.
Mm.
I recently was in Washington, D.C. for the American Valor event that they had last month. And in this hotel where we were staying was a swimming pool where they say the frogmen began way back before World War II was really accelerating. They tried out this rebreather, and they did it in that swimming pool. And so we had a chance. We couldn't see the pool because it wasn't there anymore, but they had a plaque.
Hmm.
That answer your question?
Yeah, no, that does, John. Thank you.
You could go back to Sea Hunt, you know, in the 60s, the TV serial.
Oh, yeah, sure. I'd love to hear a bit about your Vietnam experience, John. My understanding is that you have a Purple Heart.
I do. I went, had two tours of Vietnam. Like I mentioned, 4 years in the Navy, you go through basic training. Then I went through jump school and then SEER school. So, and then we were sent over to Vietnam for the first tour. Our tours are only 6 months. Then you would come back. There are three teams of UDT. One team would be overseas, two would be back in the States of Coronado. And then in between, there was the Apollo, and then I went back the second time to Vietnam. The second time I went back to Vietnam was a little different because the trend of the public opinion towards the war had changed completely.
Mm.
The morale was down from the troops that had already been over there. They were de-escalating, pulling back American troops, and we were working more with the Vietnamese troops. And so I was down at a place called Seaflow, way at the tip of South Vietnam, Kamau Peninsula down there. And there was this barge out in the middle of this river, right by the mouth of the sea there. And they had shacks on top. And all these river reinforces, boats were docked around. And I was stationed there. And our job was mostly demolition.
Mm.
We would manned to go on the boats, and they would go up and down these streams where they had intelligence and Viet Cong activity, which was, at that point of the war, they were everywhere down in the south. And they had fish sticks across the stream so the boats couldn't get through. We were called in to blow them up. If they needed to widen a stream or a river for a certain group of boats to go through, we would dam that, blow it up, and widen that so the boats could get through. And this was a daily occurrence. We had to, we went with the Vietnamese troops occasionally too. We would follow them into the brush, blow up bunkers, rice casks, and all those things. And on one particular operation, the SEAL team had been up there. They had intelligence that there was Viet Cong activity in this little village. And it was down this little small stream that got quite narrow, and they actually had wires across the stream with signs saying stay out.
Wow.
And so we needed to go through those wires, I guess. And as soon as we broke through the second wire, all hell broke loose. It was a quick firefight. They had B-40 rockets on each side of the stream. They had Claymore mines up in tree branches. Our boat was hit with eight of those B-40 rockets. And the firefight only lasted about a minute and a half, and the helicopters were called, and they came in and directed the rockets. The troops went out to flush out anything that was left, but our boat had to be towed in. I was wounded in that firefight, and when we got back to the base, the boat had to be towed in. When we got back to base, we looked down. We were crouched behind this metal railing, and one of those B-40 rockets was stuck in the side right where we were. It had not detonated. If it would have, I probably wouldn't be here today.
Wow.
But the leg wound, they tried to remove the lead in my leg on the float, and they couldn't do it. So they shipped me to a hospital. They dug it out and left a long hole up my leg. I thought I could go back to the float and be around my fellow teammates, but I got really infected. So they sent me back, and then I went from one hospital to the other. ended up in Cameron Bay, recuperation hospital there with the Army. And that was quite a sight, too, being amongst all these young kids my age that were seeing more battle than I had. Some of them lost so many friends that it was unbelievable. Fighting the Viet Cong, this is the regular Army. A lot of them were fighting. We were just down there in the Mekong Delta with skirmishes with a few here and there, you know. But these guys were fighting massive firefights. And the hospitals full of these kids. One guy was 20 years old, and he was promoted from an E3 up to an E6 in about 3 months, you know. I met one guy on the beach, which is, you know, the hospital was right on the beach, and I was walking on the beach, and this kid was crying. I walked over and see if I could comfort him, find out what was going on. I thought maybe somebody he knew just got killed. And he said, "You see that plane up there?" And I looked up in the sky, and his plane was taking off. And he said, "I'm supposed to be on that plane." But he had gone AWOL, and he'd been AWOL for a couple of months, and he was trying to hide out. And he said, "I'm going to have to turn myself in." But that's the kind of the atmosphere, some of the things that were going on in the hospital. When I went into the first briefing, when they got us off the gurneys in the helicopter, they said there's a lot of drugs here, and they said we can't control it. And I thought they were just, you know, pulling our leg. But when I got in there, I noticed that during the shows at night, we had blue pajamas and the officers had pink. And the officers and enlisted would go up and down these bleachers selling dope, you know. And they couldn't control it. And they said, just be careful what you take, because they found somebody out on the beach a couple of nights ago that had overdosed and died. But there was a lot of drug abuse in that war as well. And I guess the reason why they couldn't control it was because nobody in there really cared. They felt like, you know, what are you going to do, send me to Vietnam?
Right, right. Wow, that's extraordinary, John. Thank you for sharing that. So then, how were you chosen then specifically to participate in space recovery missions?
Well, I joined the UDT-11 team, and the responsibility for those space recoveries ended up being a part of the Navy. I started off with the Air Force at one time, and they needed somebody to put a collar around the capsule during the early space flights. Gus Grissom and the Gemini had opened that hatch, and somehow the water got in and it sunk. And they don't want to lose any more spacecraft, so they felt they needed to upgrade their procedures. So now they needed men to jump in the water and put a flotation bladder around. So when I got back from Vietnam, the officer that was in charge of our platoon while I was over there had already been on one, and he asked me if I'd like to be a part of the program. We had tests, because they needed a fast swimmer to catch the capsule to put the sea anchor on, which was a little parachute that was inflated underwater. And I was a fast swimmer with my fins, and so I was chosen to be a part of his team. There were actually three different full teams that could have rescued the astronauts. We rehearsed in Coronado with the Navy pilots, and probably about a month and a half on Apollo 10 and Apollo 11, since we had experienced some of the other guys were being more trained than we were. Then when we got to Hawaii, we boarded the USS Hornet, and we had to train with the Hornet, the bosun mates, the crane operators, the coxswain, the personnel of that ship had to know what they're doing, so we had to go through three or four procedures every single day for a couple of weeks until everybody felt comfortable. Mm. The Navy didn't do too many things by accident, you know. They make sure you could do your job blindfolded.
Sure.
But basically, I landed in my lap. I had no idea when I joined the Navy that all these things would be happening. I just wanted to get out of a small town that I was in and see a different part of the world, you know. And all of a sudden, I'm jumping out of helicopters, locking out of submarines, jumping out of boats, and parachuting. And you know, young kid with big toys.
Excellent. Now, you participated in both the Apollo 10 and, of course, famously, the Apollo 11 missions. You probably gleaned at it in your last answer there, John, but I'd love to dig in a little bit further. What was the training like for those missions?
It was extensive. At first, we were in shape, so that wasn't a problem. It was just learning the procedures. NASA had a manual of everything we're supposed to do. And while we were doing our recoveries, we found better ways to do it. And we streamlined some of the things that they thought would work. On the actual recovery and in training, it required a man that was called a sea anchorman. And he would jump in the water alone and swim up to the capsule. And he had to attach the sea anchor, which was a 12-foot diameter parachute. And then two more men would drop in, and the three of them with a 200-pound flotation bladder, and that would be attached to the capsule. And then a boat would have to be inflated. But on Apollo 11, they added another requirement because they actually landed on the moon, Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and Mike Collins. So this time, they were concerned about lunar pathogens.
Mm-hmm.
They thought, you know, coming back from the moon, nobody knew what they were bringing back. We've gone through this COVID, you know, in the last few years, and people kind of understand germs a little more. Everybody thought it was kind of funny, but they took precautions. So now they had to add another man. Clancy Halliburton was our main officer in charge. He would be the big swimmer on Apollo 11. On Apollo 10, that was not required. And so his job, he went down to Houston and trained with the astronauts a little bit. And so, because he had to have a procedure to wash him down. And the big suit was a biological isolation garment. That's what they called it. So you want me to go into the actual recovery?
Sure, yeah.
So, like I said, it's that morning. Here we are in the Hornet. The night before, you know, we've been rehearsing with them. It's kind of cool here. I'm 20 years old. I'm sitting up in the briefing room with all these admirals and high potent people from NASA and all that stuff, you know. It's really kind of cool. But then they told us the night before that there were thunderstorms where the recovery was to be, where the NASA had projected that the capsule would land in the ocean. And so they changed the site of the splashdown 250 miles. And so the Hornet wasn't prepared. They had their steam towards that all night long trying to get there. So it threw everything in kind of a disarray at first. You know, we didn't know. We never had done a recovery in that kind of storm-like situations. And so we got in a helicopter. There was three different helicopters with three different frogman crew. And we all took off from the USS Hornet early in the morning. And we all found our different positions out there in the air. And then we just waited for the capsule to burn through the atmosphere. So on Apollo 10, I remember seeing the capsule coming through and coming back like 5,000 miles per hour. And it's burning through the atmosphere. It's got a boilerplate, you know, a heat shield. You can actually, there's a trail like 200 miles beyond the capsule by burning in that leaves a flame. It looks like a falling star.
Hmm.
And then somehow it disappears. It goes out of radar. And then it lands in the ocean. Well, on Apollo 10, I didn't get to see it come back in the atmosphere. Our helicopter wasn't in a position for me to see it. And when the capsule did land in the ocean, it landed stable too. In other words, Buzz Aldrin, I think, was supposed to pull a lever when it hit the ocean, and it would jettison those three big parachutes off the capsule. But his hand was knocked off by the jolt when he hit the ocean. And so the wind in the parachutes turned the capsule upside down. And so now it's in a stable two. It needs to be stable one before a frogman team can come in there and do the job. So there was another group of frogmen right there on the spot, and they thought for sure they were going to get in the water. But Clancy Halliburton, which was the officer in charge, wanted our team because he knew we were the most experienced because two of the teammates, Wes Jesser and Mike Mallory, were on Apollo 10 on the actual recovery. I was on the backup. I didn't get in the water. And he worked with us. He knew he was at, you know, he wanted us in the water. So he was talking to the people in the helicopters and said, if there's anything we can do, I'd like my team to be there. Fortunately, we got there just as the capsule uprighted. And so the other helicopter that was drilling, just waiting to get in the water, told them, by the way, our helicopter came in. So I'm standing in the door. I'm 20 years old. I know that there's like a half a billion people around the world watched, tuned into all this, you know. And anyway, we knew what we were going to do. Our job was to make sure the astronauts were safe. We had done this so many times. So I jump in the water, and we had to have scuba tanks on because of the precautions of decontamination, the lunar pathogens that they thought might be on the moon. And we had a doctor up in the helicopter watching everything, and if we would have gone off procedures, we might have had to go in under quarantine ourselves.
Mm.
So the first thing I did was look around in the water because we were bothered by sharks a few times, and I didn't want to be jumped in the pool of sharks without knowing it. And it looked clear. I swam up to the capsule. Somebody, the Hasselwood Armstrong, I think it was, gave me a thumbs up that they were okay. So I swam around to the back where the O-ring was attached, the toggle, swam about 25 yards, opened up that little 12-foot diameter parachute, and it kind of balanced out and slowed down the capsule. Then I signaled the helicopter. Wes Jesser, Mike Mallory, had this 200-pound flotation bladder standing in the door. Helicopter comes in. They jump in, and we swim that up to the capsule. Mike takes one side. I take the other. We pulled, swim it around, kicking, kicking, and attach it, inflate it. And then they dropped a raft, and that raft was attached in front of the hatch door where the astronauts would come out. And then we had to go upwind 25 yards. They dropped in another raft. It was inflated. And there was attached to the capsule as well. So we swam it out 25 yards. And we waited. The helicopter came back. Clancy Hedelbert dropped the bag in the water. He jumps in. In the bag are four biological isolation garments. He put his on. He got ready. The other one's ready. We pulled the raft into the capsule. He gets out with that bag of the other three big suits. And then his job, he had a canister with him there. He had to wash down the capsule with this betadine and iodine and bleach. Washed it down, make sure there was no germs. And then the hatch door was open. The astronauts were given those three suits. They took off theirs. They put this on. They came out one at a time into the raft. And then they took turns. Hedelbert washed them down, scrubbed them down. They scrubbed him down. The hatch door was closed. And then we're called in to lifeguard. Mike Mallory had five Nikonis cameras on him. He gave me one. Two were his, and the others were National Geographic and AP. They gave us cameras to take pictures. And so the astronauts, then the helicopter would come back, drop down this Billy Pugh net, and one at a time they went in, sat, you know, legs crossed, and they were taken up into the helicopter. And they were flown back to the USS Hornet, where President Nixon and Kissinger and a few other fellows from Washington were waiting for them to celebrate. And while they were having a big party on the ship, we were left out in the ocean. We were waiting for the ship to come to us. And, you know, you got to remember that that capsule is like a thimble in a swimming pool. You know, it's so tiny, and that ship's coming. And from the bottom of the ship to the top is like 22 stories. And the flight deck's almost 3 football fields long. So that's huge. And that's going to be coming towards us. But we had to wait for them to get there. And while we were waiting, we just goofed around up there. And we were playing, we were horsing around, I guess, playing king of the capsule. And knocked each other off so you could stay up there the longest. And they had this gold foil on the Columbia module that came back. and it burned through the atmosphere. You could see chunks of it hanging there. And we thought we better get our souvenirs now, because once that capsule was aboard the Hornet, they were going to be guarded by the Marines, and you couldn't get close to it. So we stuck a bunch of it down our wetsuits for our family and friends, and to sell on eBay. And so the ship dropped out, a whaleboat that was faster than the ship coming, and they had a rifleman on there because there were sharks in the water by now. And you got to, my job was to stand on top of the capsule. Now, if you ever seen a picture of the Apollo 11, and if you want to recognize John Wolfram, me, the only way you could do that is with the flowers that I have plastered in my wetsuit. On Apollo 10, Mike brought some decals, and he put a flower decal on the window of Apollo 10, and NASA was pretty upset about that, and they told us no tomfoolery on this one. So Mike had brought these decals, and the night before, he said, what should we do? Well, I was the lowest guy in the totem pole. I was only an E3, 20 years old. I had no plans of being a career Navy guy. So, when I was in high school, I had long hair. I was kind of what you might call the beginning of the hippie movement. And I still had a little of that in me. I've been to Vietnam. I fought in the war. I saw what was going on. I knew what was happening back home with all the protests and everything. I said, well, maybe we can make a little statement, the hippie movement, peace. So flowers represented that movement somewhat. And so I'm on top of the capsule. I've got three of these flower decals on me. And photographers on the ship are taking these pictures. One ends up a full-page picture in the Look magazine and the National Geographic and others. And for some reason, the people keep talking about that even today, 52 or 53 years later. So the ship comes aside. Now, that thing is huge, and that thing's coming towards you. And the bosun mate shoots out a monkey fist, from a cannon. It's a knot and a rope, and he shoots it over our head. Mike grabs it, I guess, and he hands it up to me, and I pull it. And at the end, there's a hook that I got attached to a loop around the capsule. And once that's attached, the crane operator pulls that capsule out of the water and up aboard the ship. We jump off. We have to climb up that long rope ladder side of the ship. And our job's over, I guess, at that point.
That's an incredible story, John. Thank you so much. A couple questions kind of spring to my mind. I'm curious, while you were waiting for Armstrong, Aldrin, and Collins to splash down, I guess a two-part question. What was running through your mind, and were you aware at the time of the role that you and them were playing in history?
Yeah, during my high school days, the Gemini and all of this stuff was happening. Kennedy, I was probably just seventh grade or so. Kennedy was talking about going to the moon. Mm. And it was, if you put yourself back in that time capsule, it was probably one of the biggest events going on. The war, of course, the Vietnam War and all that. But the space race, all of that stuff that was happening leading up to this. And, we read about it, we studied about it, we talked about it, we watched it on television. And now I joined the Navy and I end up being a part of it. It just kind of blows your mind. A kid from a small town standing on top of that capsule, the first guy to see Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, Mike Collins was quite a kink.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the world was really, they're really into it. Front page news, all over the world they were watching. As before the internet, most of the TVs were still black and white. And, it was exciting.
Yeah, no question, John. I would imagine as you're opening up the hash, you didn't get much of a chance to really chat with them, correct?
Oh, no. No, I never even actually met them, but Armstrong signed a picture of the three astronauts, said to John Wolfram, who shared in our great adventure. Buzz Aldrin commented on me, and I got a picture of what he said somewhere. No, I had a chance to meet one of the astronauts, I guess it was Buzz Aldrin, out at the Museum of U.S. and Hort. I didn't go out there. I was doing mission work overseas at the time.
Excellent. After you rescued the crew, I'm curious if you can recall what you did immediately after. Can you recall what the rest of your day was like?
It was, you know, on the ship, in order to talk to your friends or family, you had to go through shortwave radio. And on the ship, we didn't have TV like you do these days. They would send reels to us, and we would see reruns, you know, like that. So we were kind of isolated out there. But, you know, did a lot of backslapping and stuff like that. It was fun. We landed in Hawaii, and it was a big celebration. And we had some time there to celebrate and come home. We found out that we were minor celebrities. People started getting our names and stuff, and then they would send things for us to sign, pictures and all that stuff. I went home on leave. You know, people wanted to party. Those are fun moments, you know. I'm 20 years old. What are you going to do? You're a kid.
Yeah, exactly. Got to have fun. There is a bit, we kind of covered it a little bit earlier, John, but yeah, there is a bit of interesting history in the aftermath of Apollo 11, which I was ignorant of, to be quite honest. I found it quite fascinating. And that is the decontamination and the quarantining of Armstrong, Aldrin, and Collins. You know, I've heard it referred to as moon germs, right? And I'm curious if you can go into a little bit of detail as to how NASA handled it. My understanding was that they were put in quarantine, basically held in something like a camper for about 3 weeks. Is that correct?
Airstream trailer. You remember what they used to look like? Silver cylinder, kind of like a hot dog.
Mm.
And they were popular RVs at that time. Well, they had one of those on the ship. And when they landed, they had still had their biological isolation garments on. They had a connector from the helicopter to the quarantine center. They got inside. That's when they took off those biological isolation garments. And there was a doctor in there, somebody else monitoring them. I think they, when they got to Hawaii, that whole thing was taken off, and they went to, I think, Houston. But I think it was like 3 weeks they had to be quarantined. Nixon, like I said, was there. You might see pictures of him talking to him through that little window. And we did our job. We scrubbed everything down out there. And I think we followed just one moon germ, but we got it. And we called it the lunatic.
That's good. I like that. Thank you, John.
This is all a joke.
Yeah, of course. So in 2008, John, Splashdown, The Rescue of a Navy Frogman was published. And I'm curious what prompted you to write it.
You know, during my time in the Navy, right towards my last year, right after Apollo, I started getting involved with the culture of the day. There's a lot of drug use in California, marijuana, hashish, LSD, mescaline, all that stuff, and opiates. And when I landed back in Vietnam that second time, I really didn't want to be there, number one, because the war was not going anywhere. I lost three high school friends already, Larry Smith, Carrie Smith, and Terry Beck. And when I landed in Vietnam, we were put up in a hotel waiting for a ride down to the Mekong Delta. And for some reason, I took an LSD, and I was up in my room, and the drugs started taking effect. I'm standing out in the balcony, and I can see the wars going on. You can see the puffs of smoke in the background, hear the gunfire. There's somebody down in the street below that's in a military vehicle crying out all the GIs inside for the curfew. And then that drug just took over. It was crazy. The walls begin to melt, you know, and the cockroaches look like monsters and all that. It was just really crazy. And I heard these voices in my head, you know, John, you know, what are you doing here? Why don't you just end your life here? You know, I was thinking about my friends who got killed, and this tormentor inside this LSD thing was freaking me out. I had a pistol. I took it out of the holster. I had it in my hand. And that's when I heard a little voice that I heard one time before when I was just a little kid. And it just said, John, I'm here and I love you. And I got a plan for your life. And I recognized it because I heard it one time before when I was about 10 years old. And I just put the gun down and I cried out. And I said, God, if that's you, you know, deliver me from this war. And that was the beginning of it's hard to describe when it happens to somebody, but it just overwhelms you with this peace and this presence. I mean, I was still drugging and drinking and doing all that in Vietnam, but the presence was there. Mm. And during that firefight, I mentioned, you know, that B-40 rocket right in front of me. I can't help but think of a scripture that says, know ye not that they're all ministering spirits? Send forth the minister to them that shall be heirs of salvation. And I wasn't an heir yet, but it seemed like there was provision there. And then being wounded in a leg like that, it took me out of that very dangerous place. And while I'm recovering in that Army hospital, I lost 5 Navy SEAL buddies that were stationed there with me. 3 of them went to my training class, you know, Richard Solano, Jim Gore and John Drulin, they were teammates of mine, went through the same training class, and 2 others were killed. And just, you know, just all that taking place over there really had an effect on me. And when I got back to the United States, you know, I just continued in my drug phase, but that lingered, that voice, that feeling, that presence just kept overwhelming me. It took about a year, but it just got so strong that I just started seeking God, and I would, you know, I sought him out in hypnosis and all these little avenues. And then I tried church after church after church. And then I read an article in the paper, talked about a Pentecostal revival just down the road in Pearl Beach. And when I went down there, I took a friend with me, and man, it just blew my mind. That night I knelt, repented, God filled me with the Spirit. I was baptized in Jesus' name, and man, it just was like a veil just lifted. And I remember driving home, looking across the bay, looking at all those lights, and saying, man, everybody needs to hear this. And I when I went back to my apartment, I took a pillowcase, and I filled it up with marijuana and hashes and pills and drug paraphernalia. I just felt to get rid of it all. Took it down to the San Diego Bay with my roommate at the time, and he couldn't believe it, but I baptized him and threw it all in the bay.
Uh-huh.
Went back to my apartment, gathered up a couple of cardboard boxes of stuff that I, quote, borrowed from the Navy, and took it back and laid it on the officer's desk. And I said, hey, ma'am, something happened to me the other night, and I want to return these. And then I started sharing what happened to me with my teammates. Not everybody appreciated it. Some of them would run as fast as they could to get away from me, and I could run as fast as they could. And finally, they got tired of me talking to them about what happened, and they decided to come out and see for themselves. And the amazing thing is this huge revival took place. These teammates of mine were repenting, getting baptized, God filling with the Holy Spirit. And years ago, I went back to the compound where they're having Navy training, you know, like 15 years later. And the officer in charge, I hand him a book of mine. He looks at it and he goes, you're the guy. I said, what do you mean I'm the guy? He said, you know, they still talk about that. I said, really? Why? He said, because it changed so many lives. And in that revival, there was 5 of us, 5 Navy frogmen, who were called into the ministry. Wow. It was just amazing. Amazing.
Yeah.
And then I went back to Vietnam years later. And the first time I went back to Vietnam, I remember, and it was still pretty rough. There wasn't a lot of people going back. And I think it was like 92 or 93. And I landed at Hanoi, you know, never been there, mm-hmm. the seat of the enemy. And I'm out walking in the streets and people staring at me. And all of a sudden, I'm walking down the street and this guy grabs me. I could tell he'd been drinking. He could smell it up. And he's got me now in, and he's got a hold of me real tight in the bear hug type thing. And I think, man, I don't know how this is going to end. People started gathering around. And then it dawned on me, he couldn't speak English. I couldn't speak Vietnamese, but this is what I perceived. He was saying, hey, man, the war's over. I haven't moved on. How about you? And I hadn't moved on yet, you know. Mm. And then I just felt a strong call from God that I'd be going back to Vietnam. And he said, this time you won't be carrying an M16. You'll be carrying my Bible. And, you know, not too long ago, we raised funds to build a Bible school in central Vietnam in memory of my five SEAL teammates that were killed, John Durland, Jim Gore, Richard Solano, John Donnelly, and Toby Thomas, and three high school friends, Larry Smith, Gary Smith, and Terry Beck, in honor of their sacrifices. And that's going well. We still support it. It was quite a fascinating return to enjoy it those days.
Yeah, that's excellent, John. Thank you. That was going to be my next question, actually, is what you were doing currently.
Well, I still support. I can go back anytime I want to. Since COVID, I just haven't felt to go through all the ceremonies, you know.
Yeah, that's a word for it, ceremonies. Excellent. Well, John Wolfram, how can people find out about you, sir?
Well, I do have a website. I don't keep it current, but it's johnwolframithink.com, and that's about it.
Can't get easier than that. John, I want to thank you so much for taking time for me, sir. This was a real pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
Well, I enjoyed it, too. Thank you for the interview.
My pleasure. I hope you take care and enjoy your weekend. Okay, John?
All right. Thanks. Take care.
Thank you, John. You too.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen, and James Early's Key Battles of American History, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art, inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.